You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Well, my name is Brett Glass, and the topic of the talk today, or at least the title, Broadband Innovation on the Wireless Frontier. If you're interested in finding the slides for this presentation, you can find them at this URL. I'll put this back up at the end. If you want to email me, I've got an email page available right there that you can reach from the slides. And, well, here's a picture of me at work on a typical day in Laramie, Wyoming. I'm higher up than it might look because the person who took this picture was standing on a roof with a fairly good lens. I'm on top of a 50-foot tower on top of a 6-story building. So it's kind of dizzying up there, but this is the kind of work that you need to do if you do wireless internet. I was working at this point on the equipment which is on the tower. You'll see that a couple of the radios here, and there's one above my head that I was also working on. And rain or shine, you know, no matter pretty much when it is, I've got to maintain the equipment and keep that working. Here, I'll use a laser pointer so I can stand a little closer. There we go. Anyway. What I'm here to talk about today is what it's like to be a wireless ISP, and I came to it's a calling which sort of which my entire life my entire life sort of brought me to. I started out going to Case Institute of Technology or Case Tech in Cleveland as an undergraduate in electrical engineering. I went out to work at Texas Instruments and designed chips for a few years for them. Then I went back to school and got my master's at Stanford. I would have gone for a PhD, but the advisor that I would have had for my PhD was retiring, and I decided no, it was time to go out into the real world and actually use some of what I'd learned. I spent many years, as Doc mentioned, as a computer journalist and appeared in pretty much every major computer publication. More than 2,000 published articles, InfoWorld, PC World, PC Magazine, Dr. Jobs' Journal of Computer Calisthenics and Orthodontia, all sorts of publications. And while I was doing that, I realized that my job was portable and I could live anywhere I wanted to live. I was getting sort of tired of living in the San Francisco Bay Area with the crowds and the congestion. I also realized that I could not buy a house there that would fit me, because I had too many projects. And so I took a look at various places where I might live, and one of the places that I looked at was Laramie, Wyoming, where I had been as a child and had very fond memories of. I didn't think it was as nice a place to live anymore, I wasn't sure, but I went back to visit, and within a day I'd hired a real estate agent and bought a house. And I moved to Laramie, continued to work as a computer journalist, as an engineer, as a consultant. There was only one problem with living in Laramie, is that I had been on the internet almost since its inception, and the only place to get internet access in Laramie was at the University of Wyoming, which at the time had a couple of T1 lines, and that was really about it. They were just about to upgrade to a blazingly fast, unbelievably fast connection to the internet, which is called DS3. And so there I was. I was not actually at the university, and so I was stuck off campus with CompuServe at 2400 baud. This was not an acceptable situation for me or for many of the people who had heard about this new internet thing and really wanted to get on it, who were in the community. And so I founded Lariat, which started as an internet users group and quickly morphed into a cooperative internet. I guess it's a bit, cooperative ISP. We founded it as a nonprofit telecommunications cooperative similar to a rural telephone company. We all pooled our money and we bought our own T1, which cost us about $6,000 a month. Brought it into my house because I was the guy who came up with the crazy idea and supposedly knew what he was doing. And then we distributed it among the people who were paying for it. And they were largely businesses that chipped in money to do this. We had only one problem, and that is the telephone company wanted to charge us an arm and a leg for the leased lines to distribute this over the telephone system. And when I was at Stanford, I had worked on early digital radios using the unlicensed spectrum that had newly become available. This was the great granddaddy of Wi-Fi. Along with some research at Berkeley, it actually was used by the people at NNCR to create WaveLAN, which was really the first commercialized unlicensed digital radio that ran at a reasonably high speed. What happened was that since I had left Stanford, this technology had been commercialized, WaveLAN had come out, and it was possible to use it to distribute this internet connection. So I immediately seized on it. We got some of the very early production circuit boards, and we built wireless bridges, and we put all of the members, all of the business members anyway, of Lariat on the internet. And then we also used the Team Online that came in to power some dial-up for the home users who didn't want to spend the money for those rather expensive digital radios at the time. So that went on for many years. It was, you know, very popular in the community. Until an interesting thing happened. It grew and grew, and everybody got on the internet. Everybody got used to the idea of having internet access. And people started telling me they really didn't want to be members of a co-op anymore. They just wanted to pay their money and get their internet service. They didn't want to be involved in managing this thing. Brett, we'll leave that to you. How would you like to go ahead and take this private? And so, interestingly enough, this is a case where we had a network, which is essentially a community network, and the people said, no, we want investment. We want people to be running this. We want someone to yell at if it doesn't work. They told us that they would rather have a private provider. So I and my wife went ahead and said, okay, you really want us to do this. We will do this. And we took Lariat private in 2003, and I've been running it as an independent, privately owned ISP ever since. We've been doing it for 18 years now, so we have a lot of experience in it. And we're starting to spread out to rural areas where the cable company and the phone company, it doesn't look like they're ever going to find a business case for serving them. And we're growing about the size of Manhattan Island every year. Now, what we've learned is that what we did on a shoestring back then as a workaround for the telephone company not being cooperative turned out to be perhaps the most effective way of bringing the last mile to sparsely populated areas. Our cost to deploy per square mile is less than $100. Our speeds are equal to or superior to those of DSL, and they're also superior to most cable systems. We could beat the cable systems completely on everything if it weren't for regulatory constraints imposed by the FCC. We can't get sufficient spectrum, and we can't transmit with sufficient power to be cable on everything, but we do our best. The latencies are lower DSL, much lower than satellite. The end user equipment is now readily commercially available. Some of the stuff which was on the tower next to me in that picture is the sort of stuff that we use. Costs a couple of $100 at most to get it on your house. If you're not so far from the tower, maybe it'll cost even less. Maybe it'll be under $100. The end user's recurring monthly cost, that's really determined by what our costs are to get backbone bandwidth, and that's one of the choke points that we have to face. Unfortunately, the biggest cost that we have is trying to get internet backbone bandwidth in Laramie, Wyoming. Really, right now, the only place where we can buy it is from nationwide backbone providers, but through the local telephone company. And the local telephone company charges us 10 times as much to backhaul it from the internet backbone as the backbone providers charge to take it to the rest of the world. And I'll get more into that a little bit later. The spectral efficiency of the equipment has continued to increase, but because we also cannot get licensed spectrum, it's completely priced out of any range where we could reasonably afford it and even break even. We're forced to operate on unlicensed spectrum. And there you have problems, because no matter how spectrally efficient your equipment could be, Shannon's law, basic principle of information theory, says that if there's enough noise in the air, you can't ever realize that spectral efficiency. And so that's another impediment to our delivering infinitely fast service or close to it. Here's a slide which I put up at a broadband workshop at the FCC, which shows just how cost effective this is. You talk about $25 per foot for fiber. Here we're talking about the costs, and you may want to look at the slide in more detail later. You'll see that here we're able to cover 40 or more square miles, and we'll invest about a little more than $3,000 worth of capital in the entire installation. Nobody has this sort of this sort of cost per square mile, other than perhaps the satellite guys. And so, what we invented actually turned out to be a really, really good way to cover sparsely populated rural areas, and it's not so bad in urban areas either, because in urban areas it's more expensive to dig. It's harder to get permission to do things. It actually turns out that even in urban areas, this technology is cost effective.
Are roof rights expensive?
Roof rights can be expensive. A lot of I have a lot of colleagues who specialize in obtaining roof rights, and you don't want to lock them in because otherwise they may be locked out. We don't have that much problem with roof rights where we are, because we have a lot of residentially hosted towers. This is one of our little secrets. This is something that the cell phone companies would never do, but you can do it as an ISP. We will go to the fellow who has the trophy house up on the top of the hill, and we will say to him, "Oh, you've got a great vantage point there. We will give you free internet if you'll just let us not only put the antenna up for you, but let us retransmit." And our antennas are small enough compared to a big cellular antenna that we can do this, and it doesn't, the fellow, looks at the antenna and says, "Oh, this isn't going to impact the appeal of my house. Go ahead and put it up." And so we are able, by doing this, by being residentially hosted, to cover these areas, and our expense is basically providing real good internet to the host. Now, in any case, as I say on the slide, the primary constraints that we have on our coverage, our ability to expand, our ability to perform, and our ability to innovate, are really regulatory and political. They are not technological. There were a lot of people who were really gung-ho about fiber, but the fact is that fiber is really nothing but wireless inside an expensive tube. The physics is all the same. You just have the advantage that you're able to enclose it in a tube so you don't get interference from other people. We're stuck in the unlicensed jungle of the Part 15 bands. That means that under current rules, if you buy a baby monitor at Walmart, it can transmit every bit as much power as one of our access points that has to cover 40 square miles. And if you bring it too close to the access point, you can seriously interfere with the functioning of the access point. This doesn't make sense from a policy standpoint, but it's what the federal government does, and we're stuck with it. The auction. Now, what about license spectrum? Well, the current auction regime pretty much precludes anyone who's small, local, or independent from obtaining the exclusively licensed spectrum that's being auctioned. I entered the 700 megahertz auction recently, and I was willing to bid up to a price where we would actually lose a little bit of money on the spectrum in the short run, in terms of return on investment. I should not even have bothered. A little 5 megahertz sliver of spectrum covering the part of Wyoming that I am in not even really enough to deliver really good broadband, went for $3 million. And there's no way that the large cell phone company that bought that ever really could realize a return of investment on it. They were buying it to foreclose new entrants. They were buying it to prevent other cell phone companies from coming in. And frankly, the foreclosure value of spectrum always exceeds its utility value. This is true simply because if the second player comes in, they will cause prices to go down, as well as causing churn and other expenses for the incumbent. The incumbent has so much to lose, they are willing to bid many times more than you could actually make as a newcomer to lock the spectrum up. This is one of the flaws in our current auction process. Now, what we could do, we don't need absolutely exclusively licensed spectrum. We can do with what you might call lightly licensed spectrum, such as was tried, although the policies were really not set right, in the 3650 megahertz band. What we need is spectrum which isn't polluted by lots and lots and lots of consumer devices. Sort of a wireless broadband band is what we really need. Where the operators have to cooperate and won't stomp all over one another's signals. It seems perfectly reasonable, but national policy doesn't really have anything like that. Okay, yes?
Are the white spaces that they're freeing up potentially useful to you in this sense?
The rules are wrong for this, for white spaces, for several reasons. The other problem is that they've let unlicensed consumer equipment down the band, so we don't get spectrum that's unpolluted by that. But the rules are wrong for this sort of thing. I'm sorry, yes?
Doesn't the national policy, as promoted in the 1996 Telecom Act, promote competition. Did you raise that as an issue?
Well, that's the whole issue, which I could get into also, which, you know, which all competitive telecommunications providers face. You know, we saw how the CLECs fared under the 1996 Act as one by one all those provisions were voided by the courts. Yes, it's a big issue. I could talk for a long time about anti-competitive tactics that we've faced, and maybe I will if there's interest here. Yes?
So the decommissioning of analog television spectrum help you at all?
No, that's really, really, really the same.
Be one of my questions.
Really the same question. Okay. It does if we can obtain it in a way that, you know, under rules that make it possible for us to use it in a productive way. One thing about the
TV, but it's going away, right?
I'm sorry.
There's still some LPTV stations down there, but they're going away, I assume.
I don't know. LPTV is going to stick around longer than probably any other kind of over-the-air TV, is my guess.
It'd still be analog.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But in any case, you know, this is what's considered to be beachfront property spectrum, and the reason why is that because you're going down in frequency a bit, it's easier to penetrate walls with it. And that's one of the key reasons why people, you know, people covet it so much for cell phones, for all sorts of uses. The only problem is that they did the wrong thing at the FCC. They took a lot of that spectrum and they allowed consumer devices on the band. Now, the one thing you don't want with consumer devices is for them to go through the walls of your house and have you interfering with your neighbor and the people down the block. This is absolutely the wrong use for that spectrum. However, there were some powerful corporations lobbying to have it released for that purpose. And so, unfortunately, they won the day because people didn't think about the science. They were really thinking about the politics. What that spectrum should have been reserved for, what it's really good for, is for applications where you have to transmit from a tower and get through the walls of a house to equipment which the tower needs to communicate with. That's what they should have done. In real life, they made it very difficult to use it for those applications, but very easy to use from consumer devices which could unknowingly blot out your service. We have problems like that on the unlicensed bands all the time now. I'll tell you a funny story. I call it the bikini story. I had a customer who I serve on the 2.4 gigahertz unlicensed band, the same one that you use, you know, as Wi-Fi for your PC. And this customer was claiming to me that he thought that his service was being affected by weather. And I said, "What kind of weather causes problems?" He says, "Oh, well, yeah, it tends to fail on bright sunny days." And I scratched my head and I said, "Bright sunny days? You know, okay, I could understand if maybe ice was accumulating on it during a snowstorm, but why is this fellow's equipment failing during bright sunny days?" So we came over to his house and we said, "Okay, well, you know, one day when he said he called us when he was having trouble, we came over." And we took a look around and, you know, we couldn't see anything blocking his antenna, no problem with that. And then we went out on the patio and his teenage daughter had gone out to sunbathe and was lying there in a bikini. And with her, she had brought a cordless phone and had positioned herself right in front of this fellow's antenna. Well, the cordless phone was on 2.4 gigahertz. His internet radio was on 2.4 gigahertz. QED, problem solved. As a matter of fact, when I asked her to test it, she looked at me like, "You're going to take this away. You're going to feel this from my cold, dead fingers." But we finally managed to convince her that maybe we could get her parents to buy her a phone that operated on a different frequency, and that's how we solved the problem. So we need to think about spectrum policy. If broadband deployment is really a national goal, we really need to think about deploying spectrum in a way that makes it possible, instead of in ways where we're basically wasting wonderful spectrum that could be used for that. And we really should, you know, the other thing that I put on the bottom of this slide is, you know, other regulatory constraints, although we're going to come back to this, I'm sure, is that we really need to look at regulating only when there are real problems to be solved. There are some real problems here in the industry. I mentioned before that we have problems getting inexpensive backhaul to the internet. That's a real market problem. That's a real anti-competitive practice. However, all of the focus in Washington right now is on regulations which address a problem which doesn't exist, but somebody is claiming might exist in the future. The NPRM right now, the Open Internet NPRM, which supposedly is, you know, going to institute network neutrality, nobody is engaging in the practices they're talking about outlawing. But at the same time, they're not addressing the actual problems that are keeping people from getting broadband today. And so, you know, it's really a matter of ready, fire, aim. And we really need to look at focusing on the problems that actually exist. Next slide. Now, again, I'll go through this one quickly. this is this slide is basically from an engineer's point of view, more of what I was saying about spectrum policy. As you can see, this graph is basically a graphical representation of what they call Shannon's law. If you want to get a lot of bandwidth to someone, you need the frequencies to be relatively uncluttered. You need to make sure that there's not too much noise there, because if you get down this, if you get too far down this curve, this is what we call Shannon's knee. If you get down too far down below the knee here, what happens is your ability to transmit on the band and get bandwidth through to someone drops off precipitously. But as long as you're above the knee, once you get up here on the curve, there actually isn't, you don't get very much return, and then returns diminish as the spectrum gets quieter and quieter. This is an argument for the cognitive radio technology, which I've been working on for years and want to deploy, but I don't have the spectrum to do it. Basically, if you have relatively quiet spectrum, and if you have etiquettes where the spectrum is reserved for certain things, and the receivers are programmed to cooperate and not step on one another, then you can get tremendous efficiency out of the spectrum. It's the best possible way of reusing it, especially over wide geographic areas. But if you have a jungle like you have, that's imposed by Part 15 of the FCC rules, then everybody steps on one another, you're way down below the knee, and you're in the situation where we are, where we're constantly fighting interference. Slide here. So anyway, policy recommendations, that, because so many people at Berkman deal with policy. Again, we need to devote more non-exclusively licensed spectrum to wireless broadband. The licensed regime, again, when we have these auctions and, it's winner-take-all, one person wins, everybody else loses. That's not the best use of spectrum, especially since so much of the spectrum that is won that way is being hoarded and, again, is being used strictly to foreclose competition.
Can't you have a use it or lose it provision? We might solve that problem.
I'm going to talk about that actually farther down this list of ideas. There are some bands that we can use. By the way, AWS-3 still up in the air at the FCC. We could possibly use that. The 700 megahertz D block. That didn't meet the reserve price in the 700 megahertz auction. The reason why it didn't was because whoever bought it would have to share with public safety. Well, maybe the people who were able to bid in the big auctions and bid megabucks were unwilling to share, but little guys like me would. So I'd like to see an opportunity to do that. And then we can take back some bands that are, we were talking about use it or lose it just a second ago, that are being unused by the licensees who have had them for like 8 or 9 years. LMDS-A is a key example. That is 1 gigahertz of spectrum. It is huge. And the people who bought it, it's a millimeter wave band that only goes about a mile, so you need lots of transmitters. Well, that's exactly the model which I'm doing right now. I've tried to buy that spectrum in my area. It was bought by a company which bought it on speculation and has been sitting on it. It basically has been doing nothing with it for 9 years. But they won't sell it to me for love or money because they're speculators and they have their eyes on it for the future. And I can't use it, even though it would be a great band to work on.
With the 802.11y, is it 3650 to 3700, is that prohibited in Laramie, or is that, I know it's outlawed
okay.
in places,
okay.
but it's military.
802.11y and 3650 are two different things.
I realize
3650,
that, yeah.
I happen to be within the edge of what they call an exclusion zone. They drew 50-mile circles around satellite facilities that were operating on 3650 and said that you could not do terrestrial operations there. We are just within that circle.
Oh, too bad.
So we can't
use it.
I know,
like, Miami's in that.
Another reason why we should get more spectrum that's usable that way. Yes?
Well, it sounds like you would benefit if the regulations were changed like they are with liquor licenses, use it or lose it.
Well, the thing about liquor licenses, It's funny. Spectrum licensing is a lot like liquor licensing in that, why do you have liquor licenses and why do you make them merchantable? The idea is that you'll always have a certain number. It's a zero-sum game. Someone sells one, someone else buys it. You do that when you want to restrict something. Do we want to restrict broadband? If so, why are we using a licensing model that's intended to keep down the number of providers?
Right. I was pointing out that they also, at least around here,
yeah.
You don't use your license, it'll be taken away from you.
Uh-huh. Well, that's probably good because they probably don't want too few bars either. Well, I don't know. Maybe they do. I don't know the philosophy behind that.
Yeah.
But yes, I see your point.
What often happens is the issue is that the incumbents have a different view of what the problem is. But their point of view, the problem is that somebody like you is going to come and offer a better product at a lower price, whereas...
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons I'm afraid why the licensing regime may be the way it is, because these people are very powerful at lobbying. Let me get down this list. I'll take some more questions. One thing we can do is increase the power limits on the unlicensed operations when they're being used to deliver broadband as opposed to a baby monitor. Your baby monitor might need to reach through your house, but it doesn't need to reach for miles. So it makes sense that if you're operating a wireless ISP or something like that, you ought to be able to transmit with more power. The FCC has never allowed that. It's a very simple change that they could make to the rules. They don't need to consult Congress. They could just do it because it makes sense. We could increase, in terms of auctions, if you're going to auction, or however you grant the licenses, increase the geographic granularity of them, assuming that you're going to have some more little guys out there providing, providing internet. Right now, most of the licenses that have been auctioned by the FCC have been whole states, whole regions, whole sections of the country, even nationwide licenses. Little guys can't do that. And so the auction lots have been tailored in such a way that you really can't buy them. They've also tended to be very narrow swaths of frequency. So you have large geographic areas, narrow swaths of frequency, when you need to have exactly the reverse. You need someone who can buy the license for their county, but get 40, 50 megahertz so that they can deliver lots and lots of bandwidth to everybody who needs it. Because again, going back to Shannon's law, the more bandwidth you have, the higher the data rate you can deliver. Now, here's another thing, which is basically a use it or lose it sort of a thing. Right now what we have is really sort of a feudal system for spectrum. You have these spectrum barons who are sitting on it and they're kicking, and in many cases they're kicking the peasants off the land. And you can't get, if you're a serf for love or money, you can't get a little piece of ground of your own to till. Well, one way that was handled back at the end of the Middle Ages was the doctrine of adverse possession. You go ahead, you take the you go ahead and you use it, you put it productive use. The owner doesn't even notice that you're doing this. Suddenly, you have a claim to the land. And most of you are probably lawyers, I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about. In terms of how this works, this is one possible way. The idea of adverse possession, the idea of homesteading on spectrum, is another possibility which I think we really should consider, because right now we've got people hoarding it and simply not using it.
Adverse possession can't be done in secret; it has to be done openly.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Well,
if you're offering service to the public, people are going to know about it.
Sorry, if it's an absentee landowner, and that person has no idea what you're doing with his land.
But if you're paying taxes on it, if you're living there openly, you make a claim that you own it, and they do nothing about it for 7 years, then you own it.
Exactly. And, I'd be going, if I had the opportunity to do this, I could go out and offer service. I'm being very open about that. It's one possible idea or something like it, but we need to do something about the current situation. Next thing, do not write regulations that assume only content providers are innovators, because we've done an awful lot of innovation and we want to do more, and don't assume that only ISPs can be gatekeepers. I hear this a lot. It's like, the ISP is going to filter, is going to censor and do this, but we don't have to worry about Google, because Google would never do such a thing. The fact of the matter is that I have lots of competition in many of the areas where I operate. Some people aren't real satisfied with the competition. Some places it's only satellite, but it's still something. In some places now, I have wireless competitors who are moving into Laramie. We have three of them now, who are competing directly with me in many of the same areas. So you really don't have to worry about me being a gatekeeper. However, if you can't get something listed on Google, In many ways, you're just basically off the internet. So if you're going to regulate, don't come to it with a preconception that ISPs are evil. It's easy to hate the telephone company. It's easy to hate, the cable company, the big guys. You have to realize that not all of us are big guys. And if you want there to be little guys around, you can't regulate us out of business. And again, finally, fix the broken middle mile access problem. Because as I keep on saying, if we're going to regulate anything, this is where we need to focus our attention, because this is really the choke point. This is choke point number one, and spectrum is choke point number two. I don't think we need to worry about the threat of something which isn't happening, which is what the whole open internet proceeding at the FCC is about. That's speculation. That might happen. Maybe. I don't think it will, but you know, it's again, it's totally based on speculation.
What is that you're talking about, just so we're clear?
Sorry?
That you're talking about.
The idea that ISPs will censor content.
Okay.
You know, that is speculation. ISPs have never censored legal content. There have been one or two very small tempests in a teapot where they tried to do things like filter VoIP, and that basically got shut off in a hurry. But the fact is that this is going on now, and if we're going to focus on anything, you know, we need to focus on things that are actually happening.
Before we get into this kettle of worms, can you talk? Are these two problems orthogonal, or is there interactivity between some of the issues you were talking about and some of the issues of open internet that the FCC is currently looking at?
Well, there is one place where they do intersect, and that is some people are claiming that the internet is not open if you throttle things in particular. It depends. There's so many definitions of network neutrality, and some people's definitions are pretty expansive and include even possibly just regulating the speed of an internet connection or bandwidth consumption. That is sort of the area where people some people see it as intersecting. The fact of the matter is, if our bandwidth is less expensive, then our service can come with fewer constraints. Right now, as I started to mention, some of the regulations would actually outlaw the most popular service plans that our ISP offers. Let me tell you what they are, and I know you're going to ask me, what are they? Right now, we offer residential service, a basic residential service rate at $30 a month, despite our extremely high bandwidth costs. And the way we do it is we say that on these economy residential connections, you're not allowed to operate a server. Now, the reason why is that a lot of our bandwidth that we buy, to get the best possible price we can do on it, we buy asymmetrical bandwidth. There's much more in the downstream direction than there is in the upstream direction. If someone's serving out lots and lots and lots of content directly from that connection, it breaks the bank. And so what we do, and this is strictly from the point of view of, you know, of covering the costs, not because we're trying to do anything mean or censor anything, we say on this connection you cannot run a server. And that's the way we're able to deliver a very satisfying connection to these residential users at $30 a month. That plan would basically be out, you know, the people are choosing this. They have the option of buying a business class connection, which is more symmetrical and doesn't prohibit service. They are choosing this specifically. And so we want to be able to offer it to them. We don't want that to be outlawed because people, you know, again, because of something going on in Washington where they're not looking at the sort of realities we face.
So Brett, we got a back channel question maybe you're going to answer.
Yes.
Or you aren't, if you
sorry. I'm sorry, yeah?
To go more into the middle mile issues and the discrimination there and anti-competitive behavior on the part of the incumbents. Like,
yes.
Of course, I have. It's like, you're buying the asymmetrical connection. You're buying that from who? And what choices
the
do you
only
have
game, The only game in town in Laramie, Wyoming, and in many places, is the incumbent local exchange carrier. In our case, it's Qwest. And we are buying some asymmetrical and some symmetrical connections. We buy the asymmetrical ones because, you know, we have a lot of asymmetrical activity, a lot of people who are just downloading, just streaming video, just, you know, browsing the net. It only makes sense to have more downstream than upstream bandwidth, and we get a good deal on it, so it's really worth doing. Again, that's the way we're able to provide them with economical service, or otherwise our cost per megabit, if we had to buy it all symmetrical, would be much higher. Now, there is only one other possibility, which is not open to us, of getting lower cost bandwidth. That is, through our valley, we happen to be along Interstate 80, there are three major fiber superhighways. One used to be owned by Wiltel, one used to be owned by a company called Broadwing, one is owned by Level 3. Now, quick quiz, what do all three of these companies have in common? No, they are all now Level 3. Level 3 bought the other two. And Level 3 is uninterested in opening up service to Laramie, Wyoming at any price that that we can afford. They told me that they would do it if I could guarantee them a minimum amount of spending of $15,000 per month. Well, we're a town of 28,000 people. It's very difficult for any internet provider, if it had 100% market share, to spend $15,000 a month on bandwidth. So basically, it's a way, naming that price is a way of saying no. And so we're stuck with the phone company. We've thought about microwave backhaul over to Cheyenne, Wyoming, which has some backbone presence, although it's not a major hub. But the problem is that all the microwave frequencies from Laramie over to Cheyenne are already consumed by various private microwave links. And there isn't any more spectrum being made available for that either. You can't get a licensed link from one place to the other. The other thing is the terrain is very bad. The climate is very bad there. Very often you can't do it in one hop. You actually have to do multiple hops. Well, the radios that we're talking about, you know, very high capacity digital radios, still cost about $40,000-$50,000. We have to do three hops. Well, gee, you know, we're still talking as much as buying a house. So there are a lot, you know, again, the right thing to do, and the right thing to do in many communities where the price is very high, is simply say to the incumbent, you know that you're making out like a bandit here, and you're keeping your wholesale prices above retail. You know, either stop doing that, or we may need to cap your prices. I don't like to advocate regulation. I always like to advocate a carrot over a stick. But this is clearly an anti-competitive practice, because the same phone company that wants to charge that drives our own bandwidth charges up to $100 per megabit per second is giving people 7 megabit DSL. Okay, it's asymmetrical. It's ADSL, and charging them $30 a month. What's wrong with this picture? The answer is, well, they want to put us out of business. We need to do something about that if you want there to be competition, if you want there to be little guys like me. Yes. Okay. First and second, yes?
So you said level 3 is saying you have to promise them $15,000 a month. Which is, do you think they're quoting you that fee because they're sort of have sweetheart deals with existing incumbents in the industry? Or do you think it's because that's how much it'll actually cost them, or where do you think this $15,000 figure is coming
from? I cannot speculate as to their exact motivations. I do know that, you know, various people have told me that they are uninterested in serving any place other than very densely populated areas. Which to me seems, okay, to me personally as a business person, this seems just backwards. You want to sell your product where you can get the highest price for it per megabit, right? We will pay them more per megabit than people will pay in an urban center where they have intense competition from many carriers, right? So it seems to me that they should be more eager to serve our area where they wouldn't be the only provider, but they'd be one, you know, they'd basically going head-to-head only with Quest. But apparently they do not think that way for whatever reason. I've gone round and round. I've talked to them about it. That's, you know, basically their final offer on the table was, unless we spent $15,000 or more a month, they just were not interested in opening up the building that they had built as a point of presence in our city. It's sitting there. It has about 25 empty co-location cages for equipment. It is ready to be a point of presence.
So it's not like they have to hire somebody, and that's why they don't want to pay.
No, well, they might. They would have to install equipment, and depending on how you did it, my estimate as an engineer is that it might cost them $100,000 to open it up. But then they have a whole new site from which to do business with lots of people. They'd easily make that. I mean, it's a better investment than real estate for sure. And so I do not understand it, but they have been uninterested in doing it. I really wish they would reconsider. Yes.
I was looking at your terms of service. I noticed I was looking for where it said you couldn't run servers. I didn't find that, but I did see that it said that you couldn't run certain peer-to-peer programs on your network.
Yes.
And is that basically because they act as servers?
Yes, that is because they act as servers. It's not because we're against any particular, you know, any peer-to-peer product. You know, individually. The fact of the matter is that users need to be told what applications are going to cause the behavior that they're not allowed to do. If you say, don't run a server, they'll go, huh? What's a server? You do have to give examples. And so we do mention that because it's one of the most common things that can really try to hog our upstream bandwidth.
Right,
and the user can be completely innocent.
Right.
The user can say, oh, I just downloaded that because it was the program I needed to do to download to get this movie. They don't realize. So you do have to cite examples.
And as I said, that didn't say, you know, don't run web servers or don't run FTP servers. It mentioned these particular programs. So
very few people even consider the idea of running a web server, especially when there are sites like Facebook which do it for them.
Yeah.
And 99% of what people would want to do on their own personal web server, they do on something like Facebook. Yes.
I'd like to make 3 points. One, it seems to me that Title I, Section 1 of the Communications Act stands for the proposition that all radio frequencies ought to be shared for emergency use, since the purpose, one of the purposes, is to promote public safety and national defense.
Yes.
Secondly, Section 303G of the Act requires the FCC to make the best use of the radio in terms of efficiency and service to the public interest. If you look at broadcasting, it's really, really a waste of spectrum. It serves only about 15% of the U.S. households can directly over the air broadcasting get their signals. Thirdly, have
you should hear Tom Hazlitt on this topic, yes.
And thirdly, have you considered a First Amendment suit against the FCC, undermining this authority to regulate broadcasting at all, since it is an abridgment of the First Amendment, and we now live in an era of superabundance channel and portal capacity. There's no scarcity, it's an artificial, basically, big lie.
I would love to consider doing something like that. I obviously don't have the money to go sue the federal government.
You came to the right place.
However, I will say, you know, that it is an issue of water everywhere and not a drop to drink. Well, if you scan the spectrum in Laramie, you will see nothing. Nothing. Unlicensed. Nothing.
Well,
nothing,
Reed Fox versus so FCC, Clarence Thomas's concurrent opinion. He makes a First Amendment argument there.
It's an interesting idea. Yes?
I have a technical question, if you could shift gears for a moment. You had a lot of references to the 802.11 standards, and I wonder what you think of LRE, other things, and would you use them if the spectrum was available and so forth? Or are you really happy with 802.11 stuff?
Well, 802.11 is not ideal for outdoor use. It has a problem. The technology was designed basically for situations where all of the transmitters could hear each other. They have this what's called the hidden node problem. You don't know if you're interfering with someone else's transmission if they start at the same time as you because you're transmitting and you can't hear them. There is a weak mechanism built into 802.11 to control that, which is called RTS, CTS, request to send, clear to send. You can call for quiet if you want to. And we do actually use that a bit. But the funny thing about it is that just as people said that Ethernet would never work, 802.11 is remarkably good at working in outdoor environments anyway. WiMAX at its best is maybe 10% better and often comes out worse. So we found that we tweaked 802.11 a little bit. We've actually changed the timing on it. We've done some other things to it. We do some other things at higher protocol levels that make it work better. But that was some of the, you know, what we began to innovate with even as far back as when we were using WaveLAN, which is the great granddaddy of Wi-Fi. There are ways you can make this technology fit. And again, we're doing that mainly because of government regulation. The FCC only certifies certain equipment, and it's very expensive to get it certified, so it pays to go with mass market equipment that has already been certified by the FCC. We can sell people a radio for under $100 and put it on, and mount it on their house. I'll be out climbing on their roof. I don't just climb towers. I also wind up climbing on people's houses all the time. We put up a bracket. We run the wire inside. We attach it to their home network. If they don't have a home network, we make a home network for them. And then they're online. This would be very expensive to do per house if we couldn't go with industry standard mass-produced equipment. So we find that it's actually a win to use Wi-Fi in most cases. More questions? Other topics? Yes?
Another technical topic, and I did hear about new standards that allow multiple antennas. Better support for that. I don't know much about it.
Yeah. Are you talking about 802.11n or...
I'm not sure it's n or something that... it works on
MIMO.
MIMO is an acronym for multiple input, multiple output. Yeah. The idea is that you can get various efficiencies by having multiple transmitters, multiple antennas,
and you need
multiple
a spectrum for that
antennas.
Too.
Well, the problem is that really works best at close range within buildings when you have obstructions like you have pipes and walls and things like that. At a distance, everything looks like a point. And so MIMO has very limited advantages. The one kind of system which you might call MIMO, which does work very well long distances, is the one that was developed by a company called Orthogon, which Motorola purchased, which actually uses multiple transmissions for redundancy. And it does amazing things in terms of being able to get around, literally around buildings in an urban area, by transmitting two signals that you can reconstruct back into one signal, which is better than either of the originals.
How about spread spectrum or XMAX?
Well, 802.11 is spread spectrum, at least, okay, some of the modulation schemes are spread spectrum. Some of them are also something which is called OFDM. It turns out that OFDM is more efficient, it's less robust, but the difference isn't, you know, the difference isn't worth it. So most new systems now are using OFDM, which is invented by Paul Barron some years ago. It's also something which I worked on back at Stanford. Yes.
So I wanted to go back to your $30 a month deal.
Yes.
I understand you actually offer a guarantee, which here in Boston doesn't happen. We get sold a maximum, which nobody ever actually gets. You actually offer a guarantee. Can you take us through what the guaranteed rate is at 30, and then what the other plans are? Because I'm interested in.
Uh-huh. Yes. Well, this brings us to the issue of transparent. You know, ISP transparency, knowing, you know, consumerism, knowing you're getting what you paid for. This has always been an issue with us from day one. Because remember, we started as a co-op. How do you know you're really getting your money's worth, you know, from the money that you put into the co-op? Well, from the beginning, we have always offered people what's called a committed information rate, which means you're going to be able to send a certain amount of data, you'll be able to receive a certain amount of data per second right from our internet backbone connection. This is something that the cable company and the telephone company do not do. And there are pluses and minuses to doing it. The plus is that if somebody is really a bandwidth hog, and they say, oh, gee, your connection isn't fast enough, I can say, look, here's what we're selling you for this price. Go ahead and test it. If it ever doesn't come out to that, then, we need to fix something. But if you are getting that, then you need to pay for more in order to get more. Some people like that. Again, the people who want everything for nothing don't. But at least it's a reasonable way of setting a benchmark, saying this is what we're selling you, this is what you're going to get for this price. And for $30, you only get 256K guaranteed.
And can you tell us more about what that's guaranteed, but might bounce up to something, and then for higher, if I want to spend more,
It will bounce up to 50% more than that, typically, if we've got the bandwidth. During prime time, it won't, because our bandwidth is very expensive. We have prime time on the internet just like you have prime time on TV. People come home, they eat dinner, they stream.
What specifically do you do to get assure the guarantee?
What we do is we buy enough. Right. And we make sure the network is well enough engineered.
It's architected, it's not fair share or something.
It's architected in there, and we also monitor and we make sure that somebody can't cut into someone else's guarantee. So we are able to do that. And we'll cut back the amount that people will be able to burst. This is another thing which we did probably before anybody else. We did this years ago by hacking FreeBSD. We set up the system so we actually had some real bandwidth management. As a matter of fact, our whole system is architected. Everybody gets a VPN tunnel into the server, which controls how much bandwidth is allocated to each tunnel, so that we can control every connection and make sure that it does get its share, and second of all, it can't hog. So we've been doing this for a long time. It's something the cable companies and the phone and telephone companies, the advantage of what they do is A, they don't have to guarantee anything, and B, they burst up to the sky. You know, basically you can take, you know, if you're lucky enough and you can get a burst of bandwidth when none of your neighbors is on, you might be able to burst really, really high. But that's very erratic. And you know, in our history as a co-op, we had a lot of people who really demanded a certain amount all the time. So we don't quite do that. We keep the reins a little tighter, but we also make sure that everybody gets what they pay for. Now, you've seen, I'm sure, the New America Foundation bandwidth nutrition label proposal and all that. You know, that isn't a completely bad idea. The only question is, how do you measure? I'm a little leery of some of the measurement tools that I've seen out there, because some of them combine measurement with their opinion of what you ought to get. And some of those opinions are reasonable, and some of them aren't. Some of them will knock an internet provider for doing things like blocking the TCP ports that allow Microsoft Windows file sharing. Our customers want us to do that, and we think it's a bad idea if you have a tester that says that the basic security is bad because of some philosophy that it's evil to block ports. Yes.
It seems municipal Wi-Fi was a hot idea, but now seems it's going nowhere. I wonder if you have any comments.
That what was a good idea? Wi-Fi?
Municipal Wi-Fi, like many cities, towns were thinking about.
Yes. Well, you know, Heinlein had an abbreviation which everybody pronounced Tonstoffel. There's no such thing. There ain't no such thing as a free lunch. That's really true of, unfortunately, of municipal Wi-Fi. It is very expensive to run a good broadband network that's dependable and has high quality. And you can't just give it away free to all comers anymore and get acceptable quality. People expect to be able to stream. People expect to be able to do very, very high bandwidth, very latency sensitive things. And it just, you know, I suppose you could support it with taxes, but you wouldn't like the amount of taxes. The amount of taxes you'd have to pay would be about what you'd be paying to a private provider anyway if it were really good. The other thing is that people expect it to be ubiquitous. They expect Wi-Fi at 2.4 gigahertz to go through walls. Well, I'm sorry, it just doesn't. 2.4 gigahertz will go through maybe one or two interior walls before it fades out. An exterior brick wall, forget it. It's not going to do it. And so people are expecting it to just be their, you know, be their broadband that they're going to use for everything. It just doesn't work. Yes?
Would you consider doing something like this in developing countries?
I'm doing what? I'm sorry?
Would you consider doing this in developing countries?
There's absolutely no reason why not. As a matter of fact, there's a big advantage to it. Developing countries, in very many places, they're not deploying telephone infrastructure. And cable TV, well, forget it. They're not deploying any wired infrastructure there. People are using cell phones as, you know, as their only phones. And so to do something like this just makes sense because it would work along with that. In fact, you can co-locate it with the cell phone towers when people are getting their telephone service. You can even use 3G, 4G, LTE combined with the cell phone service as a way of reaching the people if that's practical. So it makes a lot of sense. And what we're doing, again, the coverage, the cost of coverage per square mile that we have, like I said, the only thing that can ever beat it is satellite, and there are other problems with satellite, such as capacity and latency and the cost of the consumer's equipment.
What about LTE? I'm curious.
Yeah.
'Cause it's...
LTE is really just a buzzword for whatever we're going to develop next. Yeah, okay. It's
what is this for those of us who...
It stands for long-term
evolution.
That's a protocol?
No, it's not. It's basically, you know, basically.
It's the cell companies talking.
It's the cellular companies talking about the, you know, the system which shall come after me, to quote Doug Adams. You know, basically the next generation wireless broadband, which is starting. You know, they're starting to work out the details of, but they don't have it yet. The trouble is, none of it's. Watch out for the hype, because nobody can violate Shannon's law. You can't. There are just limits of physics and information theory on how much about how much data you can transmit on a particular frequency and get through to the user intelligibly, and so you know we're actually approaching the practical limits for all of these systems. So don't expect miracles out of the next generation. It's going to be better. They're going to be more strategic about how they use the bandwidth. You know, they're going to do as much as they can, but there are physical limits. And that's the reason why Wi-Fi is good enough in so many cases, because it's already pretty high up there. Yes?
I was kind of wondering, you're a self-proclaimed little guy, and I'm wondering whether there's a correlation between wireless ISPs. Do they need to be small, or is it possible to have a regional-sized wireless ISP who might be able to overcome some of the scale challenges you face? Being able to tap into level 3, for instance.
There are some people who are trying. You know, there are some what you call roll-ups, where people buy out a lot of smaller ISPs. You know, there's one right near us. Actually, there are a couple right near us. And some of them are achieving some economies of scale, but they too haven't come to our area because they couldn't backhaul. Again, they couldn't backhaul in. So if you talk to ISPs about serving Laramie in particular, they will say, well, I don't know if I want to go there. I can, you know, I don't know if I can make it work there the way I have other places. Scale helps in general, but it doesn't overcome some of the particular problems that we face. The other thing is, you really need, if you're going to do this as like a nationwide franchise or whatever, You really need to have a good person with good training at each one, because you know at each city, and it's not, this knowledge is not easy to come by. You know, I mean, I've had to develop all sorts of things and all sorts of tools that were just not available, still aren't available to a lot of people in my industry, and so it's something that we could do, but it requires a lot of work. And right now, with the government not enabling it, it is very hard to get investment. I have investors who walked away just when they heard they got wind of the idea that we might be regulated. They saw the Open Internet NPRM, and they said, until there's a report in order and we can look at it and decide whether you're viable in the long term, we're not going to fund you. So there are a lot of barriers, but I'd love to do it, though. Yes, you've been waiting.
For places where there's small ISPs, I can see what your coherent systems and net neutrality are. The situation in Cambridge is basically we have essentially a single ISP, Comcast. I mean, Verizon offers low speed DSL, but for people who want real fast broadband, it's not even an alternative. So
there are actually a couple of WISPs around here. Let me show you a site.
Just dial up.
Okay. I happen to be, the nice thing about doing my slides as web pages is that I happen to already be in a browser. Here we are, wispdirectory.com. As long as I'm still on the Harvard network.
Well, Scott's left, you might not be anymore. The guy who can make sure.
Tower Stream, I think. Tower Stream has an antenna up on top of the crew.
Well, I'm not sure why it's not coming through so fast. Maybe the script blocker is blocking it here. There we go. Okay, there we got it. So anyway, let's look here for Massachusetts. Got it. There we are. Let's see. Okay, here they've got 20, and this isn't a comprehensive list, by the way. They have 20, here we have 20 ISPs in Massachusetts. So one in the Berkshires, Southern New England. Okay, I don't have time to go through all of these, but I'm sure, you know, there's got to be one here in the Boston area. But the thing is, there are around 4,000 of us throughout the country, and you know, if you the 50 states, that's 80. That's an average of 80 per state. There are really a lot of us out there. But to tell you the truth, a lot of WISPs hide under a bushel. And the reason why they do that is because they're worried about being squashed by the big guys. They're worried that the big guys are going to either... We've seen this happen. A wireless ISP announces that it's serving a new rural area where the telephone company has declined to put in DSL. Amazingly, the telephone company decides at that point that it's going to put in DSL. We see all sorts of things like this, so you have to be very careful. DSL, so
that would not seem like much of a threat.
Again, it depends on whether we can do it at the price, because again, our bandwidth costs are often very high.
Yeah.
I have colleagues who are paying $425. This is the highest I've heard. You know, $425 for a T1, and buying multiple T1s to try to aggregate enough to satisfy their bandwidth needs. So what we're talking about is, you know, in the neighborhood of $300 per megabit per second. That's really expensive.
The only one that was listed here that was near here was Galaxy, and I look at Galaxy's website, they don't advertise WISPs, so.
Well, they may do it. Again, a lot of people are keeping their WISPs under wraps, and I hate to see them do that, but I can understand why. The other thing is a lot of them don't need to advertise because, I don't know, in my case, I don't advertise. I have no ads in the local paper. I do have a website because we get so much business from people who are disgusted with the phone company and the cable company, and also from people who they will never serve, that our hands are full without advertising. A lot of WISPs would love to grow faster than they do, but they're hobbled by the problems that I mentioned, getting bandwidth, being able to expand.
How well do WISPs do in urban areas? Are there like WISPs you know of in urban areas that have been successful?
There are some, and consult this directory, you know, for lists. I just recently visited one that does business on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. And actually, Capitol Hill is kind of a cool place to do a WISP because they have a rule in Washington, D.C. that no building can be taller than the U.S. Capitol. And so you get up on top of one of the tallest buildings and you have a clear shot to everybody else. And so this company, which is called DC Access, I found out about them by accident. I was in D.C. and I was staying in a bed and breakfast, and I looked out the window, and I saw an antenna very similar to one of mine on a roof. And I looked at which way it was pointed, and I followed it back to the access point and knocked on their door. And sure enough, it was a local WISP. So people are doing this in urban areas, and this same WISP, by the way, provides the Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi on the steps of the Supreme Court.
Okay, I'm going to just back away from something I said. I've looked at Galaxy's website again. They serve Brookline with Wi-Fi, and that's a pretty urban place. So I don't know anything about their service, but they are advertising one for just that town.
Yeah, like I said, you will find WISPs in the darndest places. And like I said, the reason why people don't, a lot of people's consciousness that there might be one there. They figure, oh, you get internet from the phone company, you get internet from the cable company. They don't even think there might be another option. A lot of people don't know what they can do even with just an air card and a good cellular plan. I have an air card from Alltel. It's not perfect, but so far, they are one of the carriers that has so far never imposed a data cap, never penalized anybody for using too much data.
Was that again?
What was
the company again? Sorry.
Alltel. Huh. Which was mostly but not entirely bought out by Verizon. But they're still independent in some areas, including that.
We ran an entire campaign office in Durham, New Hampshire, off of somebody's BlackBerry using that.
You can do that. You can do it with a tethered cell phone. You can do it with a separate air card. And I rely on that a lot when I travel.
Being small might be an advantage because I know Comcast and Fairpoint, which is a small company that Verizon kind of dumped their old landline service on. So there's a lot of dissatisfaction with both, of course.
I've heard about Fairpoint. I think Fairpoint, you know, in taking on all those rural markets, probably bit off a bit more than it could chew with the amount of capital they had.
That's not a good model.
Yes.
Or Comcast just bought NBC, which is bankrupt.
There are hundreds of WISPs, and there seems to be some organization around them. You seem to be a spokesperson. You're out there taking all the flack for them. Why isn't there more support for you? And, you know, why aren't they all lining up to do the kind of advocacy you're doing?
There is one small organization that is trying to represent WISPs. Oddly enough, some of them were my competitors and actually didn't want me to be part of the early group. I think the problem is that most WISPs don't even, you know, they're independent business people. You have to be very independent in this business. You have to be can-do. You need to climb up on top of a building, you know, buildings and mount steel that you have forged yourself, which I literally do. You know, when I did that case study in Howell, Wyoming, I literally welded and forged and cut the steel and made the tower to fit onto onto a rancher's barn, and had to go and actually part the rodeo horses, and bring my truck into the barn so I could raise a bucket lift inside the barn and bolt the thing on, to give you an idea. We're very independent, and a lot of them, it's like herding cats. It's very tough to get them into one place or agree on anything. They're not making much money, and they don't have a lot of money to contribute to a trade association. So it's a very difficult row to hoe to try to get these very independent people, you know, who just really want the government to stand up, you know, stand aside and let them do what they do, to become active. There are a few that are, but not nearly enough. And you know, I'm continuing to appeal to them to do more.
And I'm wondering if there's any areas where you think there might be common cause with some of the people who are, by your lights, maybe naively looking for legislative relief or regulatory relief. I'm actually kind of paraphrasing a question back here, which is whether there are some common areas where you can work together with some of the people that might otherwise be on the other side.
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean on the other side.
Yeah.
I've worked, for example, with CTIA, which is a cell phone trade association, big lobby in D.C., and in a lot of ways there are competitors, but they are very willing to work with us because they have a lot of the same concerns. A lot of the companies which comprise CTIA are big spectrum winners, but remember, in every auction, there's one winner and a whole bunch of losers. So a lot of them are somewhat upset with the way the system has panned out for them. A lot of them can't get the spectrum they need. So we do have some other groups that we have things in common with. But WISPs are really unique, and you know, we're really homespun, small businesses. We like it that way. We'd like to see what we do enabled rather than hobbled. We'd like for once to feel encouraged.
Yeah, we're getting pretty close to the
okay.
Any other
questions about how?
Yeah. We're over time. Oh, okay.
Okay, Doc, you said you wanted me to get more into the nuts and bolts of what I do from day to day.
Mm-hmm.
So, what sort of questions do you have?
Oh, no, actually, I think we actually covered some of those. You know, so I mean, I think we're probably covered at this point. So we're kind of out of time.
Okay,
and that's good.
Well, if people have more questions, come to see me after the session. I'll go back to my title page if I can get there.
By the way, Altel here is Verizon now, so. Forget it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, AT&T and Sprint do not have a presence in Laramie, and so because there were too few providers, they did not allow the full.
iPhones in Laramie.
There are iPhones in Laramie,
but
all
phones.
Of the people who have them are roaming.
Yeah.
Because you cannot buy an iPhone in Laramie. Likewise, we don't have Sprint, so there are very few Kindles in Laramie.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah, we got to set up for the next meeting. So.
Okay. Well,
thanks, Brett. It's been great.